Whether you drive a car, need a car, or just occasionally bum a ride with friends, you've come to the right place.
Join the editors of Consumer Guide Automotive as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews,
shopping tips,
driving green,
electric cars,
classic cars,
and plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
Here's your host, Tom Appel.
All right. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Thanks for joining us today. Hey, please give us a visit at consumerguide.com. Be sure to check out our best buy picks. This list is an excellent starting place if you are looking for a new car or crossover. You will also want to check out our blog for complete reviews of all the vehicles we're driving here at Consumer Guide, plus all sorts of other fun auto-related stuff. And if somehow you've missed an episode or two of the podcast, how'd that happen? You can stream back episodes of the podcast right there on our homepage. And if you have any questions or comments, please drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com. That is carstuff@consumerguide.com. All right, let's see who is online with us today. She is the managing editor of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk and the driving force behind the Drive She Said blog. Welcome, Jill Simonillo.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here today.
Jill, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going really well. I love the fact that it is November and the sun is shining and it is like 70 degrees. I have no complaints.
I have a complaint.
Okay.
I have a complaint, as I often do. But it got cold, right? It got cold.
Yeah.
Right around Halloween. My health club keeps the outdoor pool open until Halloween. And that seemed like the right day to close it. It was literally right. Freezing the day they closed it. Now it should be open again. Just my opinion.
because it's warm enough. Yeah, no, I personally, I would not swim outside in this weather, but then again, people send me pictures of like wool, full body suits and they say, Jill, this is for you. So what do I know?
Yeah. All right. He is the senior editor here at Consumer Guide. He is president of the Midwest Automotive Media Association, and he is the author of several volumes of historical automotive fiction, including his latest book, Richard Nixon Buys a Seltos. Welcome to the show, Damon Bell.
That is very much science fiction, too, since Richard Nixon passed away well before the Seltos existed. So,
and that's why I think it's a great book.
I've forgotten. Was there like time travel involved?
Little bit. The story was, okay. is that Pat Nixon, Richard's wife, Pat Nixon liked to go for drives with their dog Checkers and couldn't find a vehicle that worked for them.
So
in 1973.
Okay. It's so weird that you remember this book I wrote so much better than I do.
That is weird.
Did you want me to sign your copy?
I would like you to sign my copy.
Okay. All right. I will do that, but I'm going to personalize it to you because I don't want to see it on eBay next week. I don't know what kind of premium they're bringing, but I don't want you to just flip it. So I'm going to say to Tom, best wishes.
Then if you could sign two copies for me.
Okay. But they're both going to be to Tom.
Yeah, I know.
That one's your reading copy and one's to put in cellophane, for preservation.
All right. Coming up after the first break, our guest today is the editor-in-chief of the award-winning collectible automobile magazine. He is John Beal, and he joins us after the first break. You don't want to miss this conversation. But first, hey, Damon.
Yes.
Damon, you've been cheating on us.
I do. I have a small confession to make. I've not... entirely faithful to this podcast.
Cheater.
I was a guest on another podcast recently. Yes, I was interviewed for the Cars Yeah podcast. The host of that show is Mark Green. I believe he's a former executive with Griot's Garage, which is they do high-end garage fixtures and car care products and that sort of thing. And he's got this great podcast called Cars Yeah. It's his tagline is inspiring automotive enthusiasts. And it's 5 days a week. And he cranks these out faithfully every weekday. My episode is number 1677. So he's done a lot of these. And it's a fantastic format. It's got just the right amount of structure, and that he's got kind of a standard list of questions that he asks all his guests. And they're sort of in that kind of inspirational, like, you know, what challenges did you overcome in your career? That sort of thing, like inspirational words of advice, quotes that mean something to you. But all his guests are involved in the auto industry in one way or the other. And obviously there's many different facets to the auto world. But it's fascinating how those standard questions elicit a range of responses that's as varied as the guests on his show. And so it's very enlightening, even if you're, you know, not directly interested in the particular facet of the auto industry that person is from. There's just a lot of great advice and wisdom conveyed. I don't know that I did any of that, but other guests. So yeah, it's a great episode, or a great format for a podcast, and it's so conducive to a broad variety of disciplines and interests. His format basically guarantees him a great, interesting show every time.
I have not listened to the show with you on it yet. I've been too busy reading Richard Nixon by Zaselto. but our regular guest, Sam Fiorani, is a featured guest on a recent episode, and that was great. That was a great listen. So
yeah.
Great program. We will have to link to that show on the podcast Facebook page.
Yeah, we will put that link up. But if you want to check it out right now, the website is very easy, carsyeah.com. And that podcast is on basically every podcasting platform, so it's pretty easy to find.
Sounds good. Hey, Jill.
Hey, yeah.
Lexus has made a little bit of news recently. Tell us about that.
Yes. And by a little bit, I'm assuming that you were referring to Lexus's new compact IX.
Oh, Jill with the pun.
A little bit. Yes. But so they have recently introduced the 2021 Lexus IS. And while some might say it is all new, it is not all new. I would call it a significant refresh. And they've redesigned the grille. They've added some new technology. They've added some new sheet metal on the sides. The side mirrors are newly designed. The interior gets an upgrade, and the driving dynamics get an upgrade. So it's gotten a little bit of a once over, but it's not technically what you could call a completely new vehicle. And what I find fascinating about this is that the starting price, because this is the entry into Lexus's luxury lineup, say that three times really fast, is the fact that it starts at $39,000. So that's a little bit more expensive than the outgoing model. But what they've done is the top end IS 350 all-wheel drive F-Sport is they've made that a little bit less than what the outgoing top end model was. And that's going to be just under $45,000. So it has a nice tight range of $39,000 to about $45,000. And they've really upgraded the technology, which is a personal favorite of mine. And I have a little bit of a Lexus pet peeve, which is their trackpad. I don't know that anybody in the industry likes it. But
I like it.
So you're the one. You're the one. But Lexus persists in adding this to every vehicle they have. And I don't like how it operates. It's not well positioned for somebody in my driving position. I hate it. I'll just flat out say I hate it.
How that works, in case people don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, so it's like on your computer, you have like a little trackpad below your keyboard if you have one of those, and you rub your finger over it, and then it moves your cursor on the screen. It's kind of like that, but it's placed down by the gear shifter, and then the cursor moves on the screen. To me, it's disconcerting. I don't like it. It doesn't work very well. But the thing that they've done that I like that makes me very happy is they've made the touchscreen redundant this year. So in addition to this trackpad, they have a redundant touchscreen. So if you don't like the trackpad, you don't have to use it. So I just want to say a quick thank you to Lexus for that one.
Lexus is in a strange place now with the IS, and all manufacturers find themselves in this if they're still selling cars of any sort, and that's that they have to brace for reduced volume. They don't want to discontinue the IS, but people are turning away from sedans. And this is no fault of the IS. The IS has always been a pretty competent, fun-to-drive car, very nicely built, as all Lexuses are. But the reality is fewer people are going to buy these things, and much of what they've done with this new version – in addition to the freshening and the trim changes and the handling upgrades, is simplify the lineup a lot. There's less here that dealers have to stock and take up space with, and a little bit less that consumers have to choose from. But I think there's still a lot here if you are interested in a small car. And if for some reason you decide you don't want to go with, say, the BMW 3 Series, which can become incredibly expensive when you add options.
Indeed.
Yeah, well, because they have like two engines. So let's talk about the trim structure really quick. They have two engines, and the IS300 gets actually two engines. So let me back up again. They have two engines, but the top end V6 engine is tuned in two different ways. So you have the base engine, which is it's a 2.0 liter four cylinder engine, and that'll be in your bottom, you know, IS300. Then you have a 3.5 liter V6, which is in your IS300 all-wheel drive model. And then you have an up-tuned 3.5 liter V6 that is in the IS350 models, both rear-wheel drive and all-wheel drive. So there's only four trims.
Right. And also we should point out, too, this is to Tom's point of how they're simplifying the model lineup. F-Sport is Lexus's, sporty trim level. It's mostly appearance, but maybe a little bit more sport-tuned suspension as well. Now, the IS350 models are only F-Sports. Mm-hmm. Right? So that is part of that paring down process, and it does make perfect sense that if someone is going to step up to that more powerful V6 engine, they probably want a more sporty character in general. Mm-hmm. So, it makes sense that they would do the F-Sport as the only trim level of that IS350. And then also, I believe there's, I think it's called like the dynamic handling package. If you want to step up even further, the dynamic handling package gets you, I think, upsized wheels and tires, maybe even sportier suspension and possibly a limited slip differential too. So that would be sort of the sportiest version of the IS.
A quick note about the IS2, and Damon, I think you'll agree with me on this. This is a very traditional old school Japanese sedan, rear drive Japanese sedan. And the interesting thing about those cars is that the architecture is a little bit different than I think most people understand about cars you would think in the size class, in that the doors are very small and the door opening is very small. Now, this contributes to a very rigid structure, and that's great for ride and handling and noise abatement. It's really bad. It's really bad if you're a guy who's telling you to lose weight.
or when you're an especially tall gentleman such as myself.
Yeah, so the deal with that car is I fit fine once I'm in it, but I never want to see a YouTube video of me trying to get in.
dang it. Do I have to take that down?
Yeah, don't do that.
All right.
So, Joe, you were talking before we went on air about what Lexus is doing now about handling, and that they have a new handling standard that they expect their cars to live up to.
Yeah, so they've launched with the IS. This is the other thing they've done is they've launched what they're calling, I think it's specifically called the Lexus Driving Signature. And so the idea is they test the IS on a racetrack in Japan, and then all of their cars they are going to test on the same racetrack in Japan to try and get a similar driving characteristic or feeling of driving the vehicle all across the lineup. So everything from the IS all the way up to the LC.
The LC being their big luxury coupe and convertible.
Yes.
Interesting. Damon, you were working on a review of the IS, and we'll have that up sometime next week, correct?
Correct. Yeah, we had a IS300 all-wheel drive, which, that has that, mid-level V6 engine in a very cool color, too. Jill, I think you had the same. Is it called Grecian Water?
It is Grecian Water.
Yeah. Oh, that's
very cool kind of almost periwinkle blue color. Yeah, and we'll have our first spin review of that up next week. It's in a nutshell, I would sort of categorize the IS. I call it, like, some people call it a nip and a tuck. I might call it a shave and a haircut. Just, Lexus had a great basic platform with that vehicle. Mm-hmm. And instead of starting from scratch, which of course costs a lot more money when you're designing things from the ground up, they've basically thoroughly gone through this vehicle and just honed everything a little bit more, nicely. And it's been a while since I've driven an earlier IS, but with this IS 300, I did feel like, yeah, this structure does feel a little bit more solid. And the handling benefits from that are apparent as well when you kind of hustle it through a corner. And like we've said, with SUVs being the dominant vehicle format now, it frankly doesn't make a whole lot of sense for Lexus to throw a lot of money at this. So given the sales volume that they will have. So it's I think their strategy with this, just giving it a nice once over, was a smart thing to do.
All right. Jill, you wrote about the IS as well, correct?
Yep, I did. On my Drive She Said blog.
Excellent. We will link to that as well. All right. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to John Beal of Collectible Automobile Magazine. You don't want to miss this. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Thanks for sticking around today. Hey, this is the part of the show where I try and get you to follow me on Twitter. I am Car Guy Tom. That is car_guy_Tom on Twitter. I've mentioned before, Jill has more Twitter followers than me, and that fact haunts me. It haunts me in my sleep. You can help me by following me on Twitter. All right. He is the award-winning editor-in-chief of the award-winning old car magazine, Collectible Automobile Magazine. He is also part of the auto evaluation team here at Consumer Guide, and he's just generally fun to talk to. Welcome to the show, John Beal.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
John, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, pretty well.
By my count,
a busy fellow these days.
Yeah. By my count, this is your fourth visit on the show. So
fourth, maybe fifth even.
Yeah. So I hope you're throwing something in the collection bucket as you leave.
Yeah.
Well, do we have John's maroon blazer made up yet?
I thought it was yellow.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it was lemon yellow. Lemon
yes.
yellow.
Yes.
Yeah. Like an old Wide World of Sports one, I think. That one.
Did. Yep. We got the embroidered crest on the pocket, the whole nine yards.
Well, we're glad to have you as a regular guest, John. And you put out this magazine, this Collectible Automobile, which I hear really good things about. Tell us about your magazine.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's a 96-page bi-monthly glossy paper, heavy stock covers, great, fantastic, colorful photography, good in-depth reporting on various, you know, the background stories of a lot of cars that consumers will remember and know and love from their youth, and things that they very well drew or owned and drove, and that's basically what we're about.
John, do you know why your magazine makes me sad?
Why does my magazine make you sad?
Because I'm looking at this cover right now.
It makes me sad.
I've been here at midnight. I know why you're sad. Collectible Automobile makes me sad because I never seem to find time to sit down with this and half a six-pack and just enjoy a weekend. This is such a great magazine. There's so many things in here I want to read. If you can, take us through the December issue, which is on newsstands right now.
The December 20 issue is what's out right now. Well, our contents for this one. We have a story on the 1977 to 79 Cadillac DeVilles and Fleetwoods, the first of the downsized Cadillacs, when that was a big trend and automakers were starting to look for more fuel-efficient vehicles. We also have a story on the 1934 Dodge, which is a car that kind of fits in between. It's a little different from the ones that came after and a little different from the ones that were immediately before. Very interesting car. We have a story on the 1967 to 72 Ford Fairlanes that were made in Australia, and there are some things that are very distinct about them. But there are they also anybody who's familiar with a 1966 or 67 American Fairlane, and my family we got a 66, would be surprised to see these cars and recognize elements of these American Fairlanes in these Australian cars. And then we have, I think, the topic you guys want to talk about the most. We had an overview of the car, the American cars of 1960.
Yeah, I know Jill had commented on the Studebaker Champion story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's the collectible commercial vehicle pick for this issue is a 1941 Studebaker Champion coupe with an insert pickup box, which at the time was a factory option that you could order. A number of lower priced cars in America from the mid 30s up to about the time of World War II had parts like this, where you could actually sort of turn your coupe into a small light duty pickup by inserting a small pickup box that would fit into the basically into the trunk. And Studebaker was among them. We have a nice two-tone blue Champion with coupe delivery, they called it.
No, I was like completely fascinated by this because it said that it was the truck bed, the insertable truck bed, was light enough for one person to lift by themselves, but it would take two people 45 minutes to install it or uninstall it. And the reason that I got out of this, of putting this in or out, is people didn't want to go out to dinner with a pickup truck.
Oh, yeah. That's not today, is it?
No such stigma now.
I just, it was fascinating because the car itself looks stunning and the two-tone paint is beautiful. And then it's got, this pickup bed on the back of it. And, I thought it was fascinating that you could take it out and then put the regular trunk lid back on.
Right, it made it a very versatile car, they were, like I say, they were. Studebaker wasn't the only company that did this. There were Chevrolets and Fords, and thinking of another, I think Plymouth might have had something like this, and there were a couple other brands that had possibly Hudson that had this type of an accessory that you could order and basically get two kinds of use out of your car. It was a coupe and this light duty, almost a kind of think of an El Camino or a Ranchero kind of a car. It would a passenger car with pickup, some small pickup capability.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool photo feature. And as Jill mentioned, that two-tone treatment's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So, John, you guys have a feature story here, and it's the one I really wanted to get into, the cars of 1960. And I didn't appreciate until I talked to you before the show about why 1960 was such a big year for the American auto industry.
Well, the biggest news of the year was the emergence of the first big three compact. Through the 50s, there had been a growing market for small imported cars. By 1959, I think they actually cracked 10% of the market for the first time.
Wow!
That was like about 600,000 roughly new imported cars that were sold just in 1959 alone. But already seeing this trend emerging, and there were a couple of domestic, there were some domestic small cars that American Motors was very active in this and actually did pretty well with the Rambler American, first the Nash Rambler and then the Rambler American throughout the 50s. The domestic big three decided we have to get in on that. And so 1960 was the year that they brought out the Ford Falcon. That was incredibly successful. They did 450,000 units of that.
Wow.
What became the Mercury Comet, it was just sold as the Comet all by itself for the first year or two. The Chevrolet Corvair, infamous or famous, depending on your point of view, and also the what became the Plymouth Valiant was another car. It was marketed as a standalone make in its first year, but we know it now as the Plymouth Valiant. And those cars all came out that year, and did a pretty good solid business. They did about 19% or so of the U.S. domestic model year output was devoted to those brand new compact brands, and it basically it actually helped blunt that rising import car market share for about a couple of 2-3 years, and then eventually the imports began to start making inroads again and continued on their path that they're on to today. But for a while, those new small American cars were very popular.
Yeah, interesting to me, and you just said something that I had forgotten about, and I think most people forgot about it if they ever knew it to start with, that, yeah, in the case of both the Valiant and the Comet, that they were not branded Mercury and Plymouth and Mercury respectively. Do you think that was they weren't sure that they were going to pan out, or did they have designs of making an entirely separate brand with those vehicles?
In the case of the Valiant, that's almost kind of what happened. They saw that car as an addendum to their product line, but as a kind of like a primary vehicle for a lot of people who had tastes towards a smaller car, and so that it sort of was distinct from what the other brand, the established, Plymouth, Dodge, Chrysler, and it's still in those days DeSoto and Imperial lines that they were making. So they didn't necessarily see it as an adjunct to some brand that they were already making. So they weren't sure how they were, Ford and Chevrolet, and they were more than happy to market their new compact as a Ford or a Chevrolet. They wanted their name on it, even though it was a car distinctly different from their main bread and butter cars that were their volume sellers. And Mercury had the Comet had the problem of it was almost going to be an Edsel. It was being designed. The Edsel was still being made, and that was going to be basically the Falcon rendered as an Edsel. And then, just about the time that the car was being completed and about ready to go on the market, the Edsel brand was dropped. Mm-hmm. But they still wanted, Ford did not want to waste the work that they had done on this small car, and so it was sort of. Since it was bigger than a Falcon, it was shunted off to the next biggest brand, and that was the Lincoln Mercury dealers. And so they sort of inherited this, but nobody really had planned to market it as a Mercury yet. So it sort of was just this product that was there, this additional small car product that was from Ford Motor Company that was available for their dealerships.
The other thing I think is interesting is – of the three, of the Chrysler Compacts, did the Lancer come out a year after the Valiant? Is that
how
that?
A year after, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, you've got the Valiant, you've got the Chevy Corvair, you've got the Ford Falcon for 1960. Of those three, I would say that the Falcon is easily the most kind of run of the mill, least ambitious. Cheap and simple, but that was the one that sold the best out of the three.
Right. Mm. When you think about it, a lot of that was kind of the charm of some of the imports that were selling, very well, that they were, cheap and simple. And so the Ford is, the Ford is recognized as easily being the least daring but it probably the one that was the most familiar to buyers. Mm-hmm. So they just they really glommed onto it, and so yeah, they were, that was the absolute early success. The Corvair was very, you know, almost everybody had a car that had a radiator and an engine in the front, and here's this Corvair with this aluminum flat six engine in the back, air cooled. It was a, you know, Ed Cole was the general manager of Chevrolet in those days. He wanted to build an American Volkswagen, so he wanted to ape some of the engineering techniques that were used in the Volkswagen. For you know, said, well, if they like that, we'll make them a bigger one, and they'll like that even better. That was his whole thing. And so there's a lot of daring engineering in the, you know, in the Corvair. That did a little bit better than about half the business that the Falcon did initially, but 200 and some thousand, 235,000 or so. So it was the number two selling compact back then. But again, it took the real, you know, daring. There was a, you know, there was a, some daring styling about the Valiant. That was always its calling card. Those early Valiants, the first couple of years. Through 1962, and it actually was a harbinger for the styling direction that the larger Chrysler products were going to go to in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. John, you and I talked about this a little bit, but 1960 is a really interesting line in the sand automotively because it was sort of the beginning of the end of the simple brand identity. Mm-hmm. Before 1960, for the most part, the big three manufacturers were simply identified their cars by the brand. Like that's a Chevy, that's a Ford, that's a Plymouth. And when the small cars came out, all of a sudden there were models for the first time.
It's kind of the high gear for the model diversity that we have now, the, you know, size classes it's very true that prior to that, most manufacturers made a car. It was, you know, there might be differences in wheelbases and engines, but you could see there was styling continuity. You saw a Buick, whether it was a base special or a full size Roadmaster, and recognized them as being from the same manufacturer. It was a Buick. But then all of a sudden, you know, with this now, you started to, you know, you had two distinctly different kind of cars in a Chevrolet dealership. You had this kind of low, flat Corvair, in short, and then you had, you know, big tail fin Impalas and Bel Airs, and you know, you basically those cars were differentiated just by trim names and trim levels, but they were the package that an Impala was the same as the Biscayne that was the starter lane, you know, starter car, and the same thing was true like in other brands, but now you start to have these complementary model lines. And in just in a few years, it's going to start to, you know, from this point, there's going to be mid-sizes and pony cars and personal luxury cars and, you know, for just about a brand. There were a couple of personal luxuries. You know, there was the Thunderbird already existed. And there was the Corvette sports car. But they were, smaller fractions of the model mixes. Once the compacts came in, there was all of a sudden the 60s would see a huge explosion in kind of niches and price and size niches. And suddenly brands that stood for one particular price class, they'd bring out a compact and they were suddenly selling cars in a different price class than they had been used to throughout their prior history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, John, I'm flipping through this article right now, and people should know that it is packed with the pictures of all the cars we're talking about, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
All these compacts. These are great pictures.
And what's so
neat about it is you know, these model year overview articles allow you to, as a reader, put things in context in a way that you can't otherwise do. Like it provides such an interesting snapshot of where the auto industry, the American auto industry as a whole, was at during that time. You know, there's overarching styling trends. You know, like in this 1960 model year, we were just something as simple. We were just a year or so away from the traditional medium wide white walls that went all the way to the rim. They got smaller and they were pinstripe white walls. Just, you know, that was something a have happened across the board. So it's very neat to see. And 60, there are still tail fin. There's still cars with tail fins, but 60 was really when things, you know, the whole tail fin craze was starting to taper off. So it's fun to kind of see all these different vehicles in context with what their competitors were doing at the time.
Yeah, the GM cars, for instance, are a great example of that. They all started to sort of reduce their fins or make them a little bit after 59 when they sort of went crazy for them. The whole idea was to start to kind of bring them down a little bit, bring them back. And by 61, they would, with the exception of Cadillac, which basically they had made that their identity, they would really get away from, they basically would disappear from fins. And it is kind of a threshold moment for the industry, for the American industry.
John, we are flat out of time. As that's a thing that happens to us here. But I have a question for you.
That's how radio works.
Yeah. I've got a quick question for you, John. In your opinion, would a subscription to Collectible Automobile Magazine make a good Christmas gift?
In my humble opinion, absolutely.
How would someone go about giving the gift of Collectible Automobile?
We could be reached at our website at www.collectibleautomobile.com.
Sounds good. John, as always, it's great to have you on the show. We hope to do it again soon. Thanks for joining us today.
I thank you very much. It was great to meet you guys. Always enjoy it.
Your yellow blazer is in the mail.
All right. This is John Hill with Collectible Automobile Magazine. We're going to take a break and be right back.
Welcome back to the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Thanks for sticking around. Hey, Jill.
Hey, what?
You're active on Widget Dog. Tell us how the kids can find you there.
I'm active on all manner of social media, excluding Widget Dog. But if you were on, say, Twitter, you could find me at Jill Ciminiello, which is all one word, Jill, JillCiminiello. And I have to put a little plug here because Tom is trying to outfollow me on Twitter. So I have to say follow me because I need to stay ahead. Not that I think there's too much of a worry of me falling behind, because I think I have like 7,000 or 8,000 more followers than you do. But,
Good for you. Good for you, Jill.
So follow me and not Tom. No, follow us both. Follow us both.
Sure.
Follow all three of us, actually.
Yeah, you can wrap that up diplomatically, but I'm going to take it as a personal affront. Hey, David.
Yes.
You've been widget dogging. Tell us about it.
I have. That's the trend of the new year, widget dogging. I'm well behind both of you guys, so I don't lose any sleep, but I'm on Twitter at David Bell Likes Cars.
All right. Hey, guys, you know what time it is?
Quiz time.
It is.
I was trying to think of something witty, but I got nothing. So, yeah, quiz time.
In the script, Damon, you were supposed to say that with an exclamation point.
Oh, I kind of like the way I did deliver it.
Yeah. All right, it is quiz time. This is the Car Stuff Power Quiz. Today's topic is Car and Driver, published 0 to 60 times. I hope you guys are ready.
Oh, boy.
All right. Hey, kids, the Car Stuff Podcast is brought to us this week by Tom on Twitter. If you're not following Car Guy Tom, why are you even on Twitter?
Gratuitous plug.
That's going to put you over the top.
Oh, man. All right. Hey, Jill.
Yeah.
Hey, Jill. Per Car and Driver magazine, how quick is the 2021 Subaru Crosstrek Sport? That is the Crosstrek that is now equipped with the larger 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine and not the old-school 2.0. Does it, per Car and Driver, do 0 to 60 in 6.3 seconds, 7.5 seconds, 9.1 seconds, or 10 seconds?
So first I have to ask, do people still read Car and Driver?
Oh, yeah.
I'm kidding. I know
they don't buy the magazine, but they read it.
They read it. Okay. So, sorry, Car and Driver fans, not meaning to, you know. All right. So, could you read them one more time?
Sure. This is the Subaru Crosstrek Sport, for which, yeah. which for 2021 is now equipped with a 2.5-liter engine in place of the old 2-liter. Uh-huh. Did it do 0 to 60 in 6.3 seconds, 7.5 seconds, 9.1 seconds, or 10 seconds?
Because I have no clue. I don't even know what the original 0 to 60 time was, because hashtag SUV. But I'm going to go with 7.5.
All right. Damon?
It's got to be either the 6 second or the 7 second time. I will agree with Jill.
You guys are both correct.
Yay!
Yeah, the only complaint about the old Crosstrek engine, and my wife owns a 2016 Crosstrek, little slow. So this engine perks things up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Damon, this question goes to you. Per Car and Driver, the 2020 Toyota Highlander Hybrid, does it do 0 to 60 in 7.3 or 8.3 seconds?
It's a big vehicle, but you got the boost of the hybrid. And I drove one. It's been a little bit ago. 7.3 or 8.3?
Yes.
I'm gonna say 7.3.
All right, same question to you, Jill.
Gosh, SUV 0 to 60 times. I'll be contrary and I'll say 8.3 because I have a hard time believing that the much larger Highlander goes faster than the Crosstrek.
Oh wow, that is a very interesting. Reference point. However, Damon was correct.
You know,
man, you had me second guessing.
That's interesting because this is the same engine powertrain that's in the Sienna now, the Toyota Sienna, and it moves that thing out pretty well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Jill, this question goes to you.
Okay.
The 2021 Ram 1500 TRX, that is the 702 horsepower mega truck, now available from Ram. What's it 0 to 60 time? Is it 3.1, 3.7, 4.1, or 5 seconds to 60?
Ugh, and this is something that I should actually probably know because, you know, pickup truck plus SUV talk.
Sure. Your job.
And I've read numerous articles from Tim on this. And it does have launch mode. So I'm gonna say 3.1. I think that was your first thing, right?
Yep. Damon, 3137-4150.
And this is Car and Driver specific number, right?
Yes, and Car and Driver typically, historically, they get better numbers than most people.
All right. This thing is super fast, but I know from our own article that it weighs as much as 3 Mitsubishi Mirage hatchbacks. So even with 702 horsepower, I don't think that can break the 4 second barrier. So I will say 4.1.
Oh, it's 3.7.
Really?
Neither of us were right. Ah.
No one gets a point. Car and Driver.
Hmm.
Like if we did it, we'd be much closer to 4 or 5 seconds. But
that's insane.
I would be 3.1. I'm just going to put that out there.
All right, Damon, this question goes to you. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. The 2021 Chevrolet Trailblazer RS, equipped with all-wheel drive and the 1.3-liter three-cylinder turbocharged engine. 8.4, 9.4, 10.4 seconds to 60.
Hmm. That's like 155 horsepower.
Yep, 155 horsepower. Which is amazing from a 1.3 liters three-cylinder.
Indeed.
three-cylinder.
Yes, three-cylinder.
Hamsters engine. Are running really fast in there.
Muscular hamsters.
Can you read the options again?
They are 8.4, 9.4, and 10.4.
I will say 8.4.
8.4. Jill, the same question goes to you.
I'm waffling between 8.4 and 9.4.
As was I.
Yeah, because, again, Crosstrek, which apparently did not work very well for me last time as a frame of reference. I'll say 8.42.
You're both wrong.
Yeah. Was it the 9.4?
Yeah. It felt stronger than that to me. It actually felt quite lively. All right. The score is Jill 1, Damon 2, as we roll into the last of the regular questions. Jill, you can tie this bad boy up with this question.
All right.
The 2020 Mercedes-Benz E63S wagon. That is Mercedes' midsize wagon packed full of twin turbocharged V8 goodness. That's 608 horsepower and standard all-wheel drive. Does it do 60 in 3 seconds, 3.3 seconds, or 4 seconds per car and driver?
I'm going to say 3.3.
3.3. Damon, that question goes to you.
I think I got to agree with Jill. I know that doesn't make it as interesting.
Boo.
Well, it's 3.0. This thing's insanely fast.
God, wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember for the longest time, a 5 second 0 to 60 time was my, I think, kind of a generally agreed upon line in the sand for what made something a fast car.
Right.
And now we're just leaving that in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gigantic pickup
3 second.
Yeah, it's insane.
I think I've mentioned this before. My 1985 Volkswagen Scirocco manual was recorded by Road and Track to do 60 in 10.1 seconds, which I thought was quick. So yeah. This Mercedes can do 0 to 60 three times during that period of time. So, all right, we're going to the bonus question for no reason. Damon, you have won an autographed copy of the quiz is on its way to your desk, but we always read the bonus question. This one goes to Damon first. Damon, let's talk about the presidency for a moment. Per Wikipedia.
Do we have to?
Yes, all we right. do. Per Wikipedia, John Adams, the second president of the United States, owned three dogs while in office. Which of these was not one of his dogs? Are you ready?
Sure.
Juno, Mark, Satan, or Nutmeg?
I gotta go with Satan.
That seems like the safe answer.
Yeah.
Jill, Juno, Mark, Satan, or Nutmeg?
That does seem like the safe answer. But I don't know. I'm literally looking at a biography of John Adams on my bookshelf right now, and I was thinking about I need to start reading this, and clearly I should have started reading it yesterday.
Yep. Well, you blew that.
I totally blew it. So unlike the Hallmark sweater question, I'm going to go with Mark.
Mark, you guys are both wrong. It turns out the fake pooch is Nutmeg.
Jill, you need to look at that autobiography, and maybe there's a chapter called Juno, Mark, and Satan.
Yeah, maybe. And that'll be interesting. So we have to wonder who John Adams was thinking of when he named his dog Satan.
Mm-hmm. I think that's our takeaway from this, is that John Adams had a dog named Satan.
Yes.
Which sounds like a volume of historical fiction that Damon might write.
Indeed. Yeah. Tom, how did you stumble across that particular factoid?
It's on Wikipedia. I was looking for famous people pets. Because the Will Shatner horse question was so popular.
How do you know that was popular?
I don't.
He got letters.
Okay.
Stacks of letters. Stacks of old school snail mail letters. Dear Tom, love so the William Shatner horse question. Keep up the good work, Mom. All right. Damon, we literally have like 2 minutes left. What are some highlights of things going on at our blog?
We got some great reviews this week. We do, speaking of the Chevy Trailblazer, we've got a review of a Trailblazer LT all-wheel drive. That's all new for 2021. I don't think we included 0 to 60 times in that, though. We got a quick spin review of the Mazda CX-5 Signature. That's got a peppy...
That moves out.
Yeah, that's probably got a decent 0 to 60 time. At the very high end of the scale, I don't think we talked about this last week, we've got a review of the 2020 Rolls-Royce Dawn Black Badge convertible. The test vehicle we had checked in at $477,000. $477,550. That's the as tested price. So you could either have a really nice house or the Rolls-Royce Dawn Black Badge.
Damon, do you know what's quite crazy about that Rolls-Royce?
I can think of several things, but what are you thinking of?
I'm thinking that it is only the second vehicle that we've driven in recent memory that had an orange interior.
Ooh. What was the first?
A Volvo XC40.
Oh, yes, that's right. That actually had orange carpet. Yes, yeah. This Rolls-Royce has got a very over-the-top orange leather interior. The color is called Mandarin. So, yeah, and we've got a couple other galleries, a classic car ad gallery of vehicles in the rain. And Tom, you did a list of your five, what you think are the five best looking SUVs.
Yes. So they are. It's not my opinion. They simply are the five best looking SUVs.
It's your opinion. It's your opinion. I'm not saying it's a bad opinion, but it's your opinion.
If it matters, Damon, no one is giving me any slack on the LaForza. And if you don't know what a LaForza is, you need to check out the article.
Mm-hmm. All right. I wouldn't give you much slack on that either. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Damon. That's it. We ran out of time yet again. How does that happen?
We talk too much.
Yeah, that is it, actually. That is exactly how that happens. All right. And that is a show. Special thanks to our guest today, John Beal of Collectible Automobile Magazine. You can check out Collectible Automobile and subscribe, which is a great thing to do as a Christmas gift to Collectible Automobile at collectibleautomobile.com. Special thanks to Jill Simonillo. Special thanks to Damon Bell. As always, thanks to Lady B and the good folks here at WCPT AM 820 in Chicago. As always, thanks to my radio mentor, Steve and Johnny. And you can always reach us at carstuff@consumerguide.com. That's carstuff@consumerguide.com. All right, let's talk about cars again next week.